Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Where does memory hide? While most of us trust our recall of the watershed events in our lives, those recollections can swirl and shift and change directions. They can be altered by constant repetition, or they can disappear entirely. Such was the case for more than 20 years after Ari Folman served in the First Lebanon War of 1982. The conflict was a painful one for both sides. Following the assassination of Lebanon's president-elect, Gamal Bashir, Christian phalangists carried out a civilian massacre at Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon while Israeli troops stood by. After the killings, hundreds of thousands of Israeli citizens took to the streets in protest, and then Defense Minister Ariel Sharon was fired. Folman was in Lebanon while it all went down, a 19-year-old soldier in the Israeli army. But he didn't dwell on that experience and, in fact, realized to his deep surprise decades later that he had almost no memories of the war at all. His new animated documentary explores Ari Folman's search for his own history and that of his comrades in arms. It's called Waltz with Bashir and will open January 16th at the Angelica Theaters in Dallas and Plano. Ari, welcome to Think.
Welcome. Thank you.
You don't consider this to be, in the classic sense, a war movie. So what is it about?
Well, the film is mainly about search for lost memory. It tries to realize or get any kind of conclusions in regards of where do our memories go when we try really hard to suppress them. Do they live inside us? Do they live outside us? Do they die like we wish they would? Can we live all our lives without thinking about specific events in the past, or it's not up to us anymore, and one day you wake up in the morning and you're haunted by your past, and then you have to go through a journey like I did.
Do you remember deliberately trying to suppress those memories?
I deliberately suppressed those memories. By all means, I was released from the army at the age of 22, and I took this decision, I remember very well, to try and treat my army service as my previous life, a life that has nothing to do with my current life, and I mean when I was 22. And I disconnected all strings I had with people who served with me in the army. I didn't go to any meetings, I didn't answer calls. I just tried really hard to forget. And when you try hard, you can succeed.
So no reunions, you didn't really talk to your friends.
No reunions, nothing, yeah. No.
So then a friend of yours, who I guess was in a different unit, but was also in the Army?
Yes.
Called you and said, let's have a drink, I have to talk to you about something.
Yes, he called me and he said that he had this dream that 26 rabid wild dogs are chasing him in the main street of Tel Aviv, where we live, coming to kill him, literally. And it's a repeating dream he has every night. And the dream comes from a place he realized that while he was in his army service, his job was to eliminate dogs in the villages where the army was going to look for terrorists. And since in the middle of the night, the dogs, they come out of the village first, and they can wake the whole village and kill the surprise of the operation. He was chosen to shoot the dogs. And they told him that he's too fragile to shoot people, so they told him he should shoot the dogs. And then one day, 20 years later, those dogs came back in his dreams, and they came every night. And he seeked for help, and he came to meet me in the middle of the night, and this is how it all rolled out.
So after you heard that story, it had a profound effect on you.
It had an effect on me. I was going myself through different kind of things that period of my life, and I had the first memories coming back to me from the war, and I had this vision that I'm with friends of mine naked in the middle of the sea, swimming while there is something terrible going on in the city of Beirut. And this is where it all started. This is where the film starts, and this is where we we launched the project.
So the film opens with the scene of the dogs running. This was something that would have been almost impossible. I mean, you could have shot it, and I guess you did shoot it as a guide. Oh. But you couldn't have told a dream in a documentary with video or film.
This film was always meant to be animated. It was always meant to be a drone film. There was no other way to do it. I wouldn't do it any other way anyhow. And if you look at all the elements that there are in the film, and that includes memory, lost memory, hallucinations, subconscious, drugs, daydreams, visions, and war in general, which is probably the most surreal thing on Earth, at least to me, the only way to tell one story that consists of everything that I just said would be to draw it. And it gave me, as an artist, as a filmmaker, total freedom to go from one dimension to another. And as I said, it was the only way to do it. Drawings.
It was a gutsy move, not only for the subject matter, but also my understanding is that there is not a strong tradition in Israeli cinema of animated film. This is the second one in like half a century?
It's the second one, and the first one was done in 1961. So, yes, there's no tradition at all. There's no legacy. There's nothing. It can be problematic when you're looking for a quality crew. And, I mean, we had only 8 animators doing this film. When we needed 2 more, we couldn't find them. But on the other hand, I think that the fact that you don't have any tradition really frees you. And if you imagine trying to imagine a Japanese guy making the same film, it would have been impossible for him. I mean, just to break through the tradition of Japanese anime and way of drawings and the way they do things, even here in America, I think it would have been impossible to raise money for this kind of film.
People who want to see images from the film, and there are also some trailers, those are available at waltzwithbashir.com. I wonder if you can talk about the process for deciding exactly what those images were going to look like. Did you go through a series of several different visual styles before you kind of came upon what you used?
First, I chose the main characters of the illustrators. They have their own style. And there's a limit to what you can do with illustrators in terms of changing their style. I was obsessed in the beginning of the project to make it a realistic design as much as we could. And I pushed towards realism. And I was thinking that the only way for the audience to get emotionally attached to the characters in the movie would be to make it in realistic way of design. So we had to put as much details as we could in the faces of the characters, meaning shades, wrinkles, contours, whatever really gives you, I mean, human face. And of course, the more details you have in a specific face, the more complicated it would be to move the character in animation. And this is the main design of the film. It's really realistic. It's more than everything. It's influenced by graphic novels and not by any kind of other animation film. And the story plot is influenced by stories I used to read when I was in my 20s. All of them from authors that participated in war but then came back home and took a step backwards and they could look upon what happened in a very ironic way, sometimes funny, like Kurt Vonnegut, like Catch 22, like William Saroyan. And I was influenced by those books.
Let's talk for a minute about the sort of coming home and going back. A lot of Americans who have served, even in combat, don't fully appreciate, I don't think, the fact that you can be in combat one day and then take a 20-minute, for you it was a 20-minute helicopter ride when you were on furlough. What was that immediate shift like for you?
When I made Waltz of Bashir, I didn't think about the time it took us to go back home from the middle of the war. But then while traveling a couple of months ago, I read this article in an American newspaper, and I realized that for an American soldier serving in Iraq, it might take 6 days to to come home to the Midwest somewhere. And I thought, okay, how long did it take us? And then I realized, well, it took us 20 minutes. And think that you are in the middle of battle and it's hell and people are dying and it's really bad for you. And then you go on a helicopter and you land in your hometown and people are really happy and they're partying everywhere. It's the beginning of the 80s, new music, new drugs, everything was beginning to happen in Israel. And it was something that, as a very young person, it was really, I mean, you couldn't take it. You couldn't understand. Going back home was even difficult than staying there because you knew that after 48 hours you have to go back. In 20 minutes you're back. And it really made no sense at all.
This was incredibly hard for you. There is one slightly humorous scene in the film where you go to your father and try to explain to him how upsetting this is for you. And he basically said, well, in my war, it was even worse.
Yeah, it is. Well, it's the generation gap, as we say in Hebrew. He told me then that, like, in Second World War, Russian soldiers, when they came back home, it took them so long to come back, so the only thing that they could do is kiss their ladies and go back to the train and go back to the front. And, of course, when you illustrate it, it becomes a funny story.
Your parents were both in Auschwitz.
Yes.
How much did their experiences there frame your relationship with them and your understanding of who you were and who they were?
Well, it's a tough question. You can't just answer it in a few sentences. I think that any home of a Holocaust survivor is different than another because each one of those people took it differently and survived in a different way. Basically, I think it is in the DNA of everyone in Israel and Jews in general, I think. And this is why, I mean, a lot of the approach towards what happened in the Sabra and Shatila massacre in Israel was so outrageous after the first newsreels were out. I don't know if people knew exactly why they're reacting so strongly, but I knew, at least I knew. And I think that for us, watching any kind of newsreels that contain a mass murder is always just a reflection of the past, no matter where it is. And of course, there's no comparison, and no comparison could be done, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is that it immediately just lit the past. And you can see it in the film as well.
So Israelis, having seen these images of people coming out, women and children and the elderly with their hands up over their heads being marched out at gunpoint, immediately that touched that nerve.
Immediately. And while traveling with the film in Europe, I was asked a lot about the comparison that the interviewers in the film do sometimes. And I was never asked this question in Israel because it's so obvious.
Ari Folman is my guest. He is a filmmaker. His animated documentary called Waltz with Bashir will open January 16th at the Angelica Theaters in Dallas and Plano. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is filmmaker Ari Folman. His film Waltz with Bashir is an animated documentary about the First Lebanon War that will open January 16th at the Angelica Theaters in Dallas and in Plano. Ari, how do you relate today to that sad-eyed 19-year-old that we see throughout the film?
First, I relate to him, and this is a big progress in my life. I mean, before I started the project, I was totally disconnected to the guy I used to be when I was 19. Not in a stupid new age way, but still, I mean, I could recognize a photo of myself, but I would say this guy, I know him from my previous life. Today, this guy is part of me, and I live in peace with him, you know, and it's a very big thing. To achieve after a single feature film.
I have to wonder, of course, you go back, part of the film process is that you went and talked to other people who were there with you and you got their stories. And I wonder if now you've sort of internalized those perspectives as well, if that becomes part of your vision of your experience of the war.
Yes, I do in many ways. I mean, it's not that I went through total amnesia when I was released from the army. It's nothing like that. I had the main storyline. But I had black holes, gaps in memory. And those were the gaps that I wanted to fill by making this film. So, you know, history is always subjective. Your autobiographical story is always subjective. And this is what I believe in now. And this is it. This is my story for now, you know.
Why did you want to go back and recover all that? You had to have imagined that something unpleasant was there that you had hidden away.
I think that you can live suppressed all your life and it's great. I'm not a great believer in psychotherapy, so I can say that suppressing is a good method of going on with your life. I don't think that for everyone it's necessary to dig obsessively with your past. And I think it helps a lot of people just, you know, maintain themselves. But once things are out, and some of the times it's just not up to you, they emerge from you. It could be happening from something that you went through that reminds you. It could happen by psychotherapy. It could happen by, I don't know what, by a dream. But once it's out, I mean, you have to deal with it. There's no way of suppressing. So the hardest thing was taking the decision to go on with it and make the research and try to figure out what happened. Once I took the decision, it was only natural to do it. There was no way back anymore.
You mentioned earlier that you were really obsessive about wanting this to be realistic, although it was animated. And so you went through and actually shot the entire thing on film or on video so that you would have something to work off of, to give the animator something to work off of.
Yeah, I realized I did animated documentary in my previous work, and I realized that location sound, I mean, things you shoot outside in the street, the sound is not, I mean, the human ear is completely non-tolerant towards location sound because we are used to all those beautiful Disney movies since we were kids, and they all have crystal clear sound. So we had to do everything in studio, and we made all the interviews in studio, and we tried to dramatize the scenes of the film in the studio, whatever we could. We edited it into a feature-length video film, and this was the reference for the film. No way that we drew over the video. It's not a rotoscope technique. I won't go into too much details. But this was, I mean, the sound was the reference for the complete film.
How difficult was it for you to interview people that you knew about something that was very personal in their lives?
Well, at first we advertised on the internet that we were looking for stories from the First Lebanon War that occurred in the beginning of the 80s. And we got a response from more than 100 people, 100 men. And I thought by the response And by the way, people were talking to us that they were waiting for more than 20 years for someone to come and hear their stories. They were just urging to talk. So for many of them, it was a catharsis, and it was something, you know, it was help. And they wanted to talk, not for all of them. Weird enough, my best friends didn't want to talk. And they ran away. They never answered my phones. And the ones who did make the interviews, in the last moment, they got cold feet. And we had to invent them new faces in the film and everything. But they were just my best friends, of course, as usual.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. GK asks if you'd comment on why you chose the title that you did, Waltz with Bashir.
Waltz with Bashir has double meaning. First is named after a crucial scene in the movie. We're in the middle of battle. There's this guy, he takes his machine gun and he runs in the middle of the junction in a really suicidal way of behavior and start dancing between the bullets. This scene really happened in reality, but I don't know how long it took. It could have been 2 seconds, it could have been 30 seconds. I mean, but at least in terms of imagination, it was endless. And the other reason is that it's a metaphor, it's a symbolic way, Waltz of Bashir, to sum in one sentence, in one title, the relationship between the Israeli government and their allies, which were the Christian militia. This dance together with the Christians, I mean, it ended really bad. It ended with a massacre. So it's kind of a symbolic title.
For people who don't know the history, Bashir, the president-elect, had been supported by the Israeli government.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How aware were you of the nuances of the war and the reasons for it when you were sent over there at 19?
I was pretty much aware. But, I mean, it's not that I went through a process of becoming a pacifist or something like that, and it took me time to realize. I mean, for me, it took 6 hours. I was raised in a very good family, and I never saw any violence till I was 19, you know, and the first couple of years in the army were just playing games, like playing today video games. We were running on the hills, shooting at paper, images. It was playing games with the guys. And I was in a very good unit, you know, very respectable. And most guys go there just to impress the girls and not because of good reasons. And then the war started, and after 6 hours, I saw so much destruction, so many dead people. I saw so many of my friends that this was it for them. They were gone. That I realized immediately that, you know, the game is over. We're not running in the hills now. And it's just war, any war, is really a useless idea. Because we were far away from home. It had nothing to do with protecting our families. It had nothing to do with our life being in Lebanon. And in that essence, I think that Waltz of Bashir has a very universal statement. It's not just Israeli. I mean, it could have been written by anyone who participated in war. It could have been written by anyone who woke up one morning in a remote city and he's being shot at and he asks himself, you know, what the hell am I doing here? Why am I here? And this is a very, I mean, very universal statement.
I think in so many ways the animation is particularly a brilliant stroke in trying to show how surreal it is in war, because suddenly these images look like real life, but they're not real life, and you're in this place where it's just chaos and confusion, and no one really knows what's happening next.
Yes. You know, in a lot of American big anti-war movies, you see that war is bad for you, of course, because this is the statement of the film. But on the other hand, you see that there's a lot of glory in war and a lot of glamour in war and bravery and brotherhood of man, and the men are always so cool. And I didn't want to show that because I just completely don't believe in it. And I think that in the eyes of a common soldier like I used to be when I was 19, There's no glory in war, and there's no glamour in war, and there's no bravery in war. There is nothing, because you don't have any decision upon your life. You don't know if you will live till the next morning. You don't know where you are, basically. You don't know where you're going in the next hour or two. You are totally clueless. And I just wanted to make this very clear in the film that, I mean, if a teenager watches it, he won't say in the end of the film, yes, war is bad for you, but I want to be the guy in the movie. Nobody wants to be the guy in Waltz with Bashir, no way.
What do you think is the stain left on your generation of having participated in this conflict?
I don't know if it's weird, if it's good, if it's bad. I try not to judge it, but I think there is no guilt around that war. Maybe because it's always easy to blame the leadership. And it was a breaking point, really, in the relationship between the people and the leadership in Israel back then, in the beginning of the 80s. And unfortunately, it happened again 2 years ago, just the same. So you can see that nothing has been learned. And I don't know, I don't believe in the terms collective. Collective stain, collective guilt, collective therapy, collective, collective. I hear it all the time while traveling with the film. But I'm just a filmmaker. The biggest thing I can do is a very personal story that if I'm talented enough, I can tell it with the tools of filmmaking. And this is it. As for the word collective, I mean, it's too big for me.
I'm wondering about, don't speak collectively, but speak as the son again of Holocaust survivors. If there is sort of a struggle, because almost no matter what you've been through, it can't compare with what your parents' generation had to survive in order to get to Israel.
I think it is true only in one manner. I think for our parents who came from Europe after the war, it was for them, I mean, it was nothing that they can think or judge. They wanted a big Israeli army, a strong army. And for them, it was, you know, just the revival or the revenge of the past, that we have a strong army that can always, I mean, make the country secured. And sometimes they didn't see, and I mean, they didn't identify what was going on. And it didn't matter to them if it was justified, not justified. It's Israel, it's the nation of the Jews. Now we need a strong army so a second Holocaust can't appear. But you know, the Arabs, thanks God, they're not the Nazis. They don't want to throw us into the sea. And the comparison is not, I mean, doesn't exist anymore. It shouldn't exist. And if you go through just frightening, you take it to the wrong places, I think, in many times.
In the film, Waltz with Bashir, obviously we empathize with you as a young soldier and with the other young men that you profile in the film. But there is a different set of victims that we see, the people who were at Sabra and Shatila. Did you worry about balancing where people's sympathies fell at the end of the film?
Yes, I did. I can tell you that when I started the project 5 years ago, it was really tempting to make a kind of Rashomon about what happened in Sabra and Shatila, meaning to interview an Israeli soldier, that would have been probably me, and a couple of friends, a Falangist soldier from the Christian militia, a survivor or two from the Sabra and Shatila camps, and a Lebanese official. It would have been, in terms of production, the easiest thing to do. You can do it now because you have the internet, you have access to a lot of people, and they have their sites. And I checked that, and very quickly I decided not to do it because I think that part of their emancipation and seek for freedom is to tell their own stories. And I think I would really much like to see a Palestinian film about what happened in the camps from their eyes, not from our side. We know our side. We want to see it from their eyes. And I saw this incredible film called Massacre, Testimonies of Five Falangist Soldiers. It was their story. So I wanted to really keep it on a very personal level. Although I knew I might be criticized for that. But for me, this was the only way to tell the story. And as I said, I'm waiting for their films.
Has the film been screened in Lebanon?
No, we can't do it. We're trying. It will be screened in private screenings very soon. It was screened in Ramallah in the West Bank. We had few screenings there, very successful, although there was criticism saying that the film didn't take enough blame for the Israeli part in Lebanon. There will be a special screening for the Jordanian King that we're organizing now. There were articles in the Arab press praising the film. And I, in general, I don't believe really that films can change the world, unfortunately. But they can make small bridges between people. And just by the emails I get from Palestinians in Europe who saw the film, I see that it does. It does make small bridges between people.
Did it even change the way you understood what your role was?
As I told you, my mind was already set after 6 hours in the war, although I had to go through 9 months there. But it made me even more extreme about the way I look now at wars, anywhere.
Filmmaker Ari Folman is here. We'll return to our discussion about his new documentary, Waltz with Bashir, after the break. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest is filmmaker Ari Folman. His animated documentary, Waltz with Bashir, opens January 16th at the Angelica Theaters in Dallas and Plano. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. I wonder if you can talk about the characterization of the film. The genre, as you consider it, is animated documentary. There are people who are going to say, well, it's not a documentary because it includes sort of fantasy sequences. Are you bothered by people's sort of obsessive need to put films into a box?
No, not anymore.
You need to get over that.
I'm not bothered at all. When I started the project 5 years ago, I declared it an animated documentary, and I traveled to the pitch at the Toronto Documentary Film Festival. It's a very, rated, highly rated pitch. And I had a three-minute scene, and I declared it as the first ever animated documentary feature-length film to be. And it was a stupid idea, really, because I'd never do it again. Because I think film establishment is so narrow-minded in many ways that immediately declaring this thing was threatening a lot of people. So I went to documentary funds. They said, listen, if it's animated, it's not documentary. Go to animation funds. I went to animation. They told me, great, great idea. But if it's documentary, it's not animated. So we can't support you. And I fell somewhere between the chairs, and nobody wanted to support the film in the beginning because of, just titling it as a documentary. Today, I don't really care if people say it's a documentary, it's not. Who decides where a documentary ends and fiction begins, where life ends and fantasy begins? I mean, the borders are so shallow, you know, and I mean, you can't really put your hand on it. And there's no higher committee that can decide, at least not for me. So, I mean, if I was clever enough 5 years ago to say that, okay, I want to make this really personal autobiographical film and I want to do it animated, I think it would have been much easier for me. Just not mention the word documentary.
A lesson learned for the future. Will you use this format again, do you think?
Yes, I will in my next film, but not as a documentary, as you know already. It's going to be pure fiction. I optioned a science fiction book of my favorite science fiction writer. His name is Stanislav Lem. He wrote Solaris, that was done here by Soderbergh and in the 17th by Tarkovsky. And we're going to adapt it in animation.
Are you finding when the story is fiction that you have almost too many options for the directions that you can go? Were the limitations helpful when you worked on the documentary?
No, not really, because I think documentary options are endless as well. I think that any kind of filmmaking in the end is really subjective. Sometimes it is pretentious and it pretends to be objective, but there's no really any objective kind of filmmaking, not even a documentary. I mean, just think about it, that in the end, you are left with 300 hours of material that you have to choose from them 90 minutes length film. It's a subjective decision. You can make 5-6 different films with different agenda in it. So there's nothing really objective. The options are endless. And more than that, I'd say that a good documentary filmmaker doesn't narrow his mind in the beginning at all, and he opens all the options, and he sees later what kind of film he's going to make.
There's a scene in the documentary where you ask one of the characters if he minds if you sketch a little bit as you're preparing for this project, and he says, as long as you don't, you know, take my picture, you can sketch. Are you actually, are you a visual artist?
A bad one. I'm a bad visual artist. I'm a bad musician. I hope I'm a better filmmaker. And this is why I love using all those really talented musicians and illustrators in my films.
How often was your vision and theirs different? And how did you work on that?
I think once you choose the right people for a project, and you give them the basic tools of your imagination, how you want things to be, you have to give them a lot of freedom. Like, you don't take a very talented musician like we had and tell him in what notes or scales to write the music. It's up to him. Same thing with illustrators or artists, fine artists. I mean, as long as you structure the thing and you say, I want it realistic, I want details, I want the atmosphere to be melancholic, or I want it to be this and that, give them the opportunity to express themselves.
Were you struck by how many of the people that you talked to whose memories were equally sort of dreamy or based in, you know, hallucinations they had had or things that they had literally dreamed, as opposed to people who said, I don't remember it very clearly, but these three things happened specifically?
I don't know. I'm trying to research that for my next film. It has a lot to do with psychopharmacology drugs. So I met this professor, really intelligent guy, psychiatrist in Israel, before I flew here to America. And he told me, listen, if you're talking about psychiatric drugs or just drugs in general, don't think that the issue of the material will make people bring imaginary stuff from their subconscious, because some people, their minds are just empty. I was shocked, you know, I never thought about it. All my life, I thought that everybody has something. back there in the brain that if you do it right, it can be out with all the imaginary stuff on Earth. But then comes this guy. I mean, he is more experienced. He knows what he's talking about. And he says, no. So I can understand a little better how people remember the whole story, how they remember part of it, or how they just, in a way, build a completely parallel story to the truth. You know, it's up to them.
As an artist, do you think that your memories of the past are more vivid once they're out there than, say, the average person who, you know, drives a truck or...
This is what I don't know. This is what I don't know. I can tell you that I met a neurobiologist that now is a neurobiologist, is doing here in America his postdoctoral research. And he used to be with me in the army in the war. And he told me that now in his field, they're researching memory. And they think that if you have a memory from something that happened to you, it could be traumatic, could be not. And you don't suppress it. You go on living with it. And it's a story that you always tell. You meet your new boyfriend, you will tell him. You have kids, you marry, you tell the kids. You know, you grow up, you tell the story. The gap between the beginning, I mean, how it really happened, and the end of the story 20, 30, 40 years later is huge. It's a completely different story. The story will have life of its own. Not because you deliberately did it, but because every time you tell it, you put new details in. But if something happens and you immediately suppress it, they think that there is a biological shell that covers your memory, this single memory. And if something happens 20 years later and this shell is broken, it is literally broken. So the memory will be fresh as it really happened 10 minutes ago. I don't know how they can prove it, but this is, what he's doing in his life, trying to prove this thing. I decided to believe in it anyhow.
Well, having had a memory like that with a shell broken off of it, that must have been a horrible thing to experience one more time.
Well, I've been asked that question a lot, but... And it would have been natural for me to say, yes, it was horrible. But the truth is that it was not. As I told you, it was natural. It's as if you take really a big decision in life, and once you go for it, it's natural to do it.
An email from Rollins asks, have you been able to mourn for, maybe even cry for, the personal loss of the young man that you rediscovered in creating this film?
That's an incredible question. I think I have a lot, but maybe not so straightforward. Maybe I did some sublimation in life that I cried for different things. It was hard just to specify on a specific point to say, okay, my youth was lost when I was 19 because of the Israeli government sending me to an unnecessary war. I mean, you have to be really clever to identify that when you're 19, and I was not, probably.
There have to be people in your life, your friends today, your wife, your kids, who don't know that person.
Who? The one that I used to be at 19?
Yeah.
I hardly know him, so how could they know him?
Mm-hmm. Do you, I know your children right now are very young. Are you already sort of nervous about the day that they want to see this? Or will this make it easier to talk to them about what you experienced?
Well, my kids, they grew up both their parents are filmmakers, so they grew up on sets. When they get out of kindergarten at 3:30, they usually go to a set. So this is their life. And they will see it as young as I can make them see it. I don't know. And this film was done, a lot of it, for them in many ways. Because, as I said before, it is an anti-war declaration for me. I think, unfortunately, you can't decide for your kids. I mean, when they're 18, if they want to participate in wars, go to the army, they will do it. They don't give really a damn about you. And it's up to them. So the only thing you can really do is just give them the right tools to think in terms of education about what you think about violence, about wars in general. And hopefully, I mean, you will clarify that so well that they will take the right decisions, but you can't do anything more than that.
It's so interesting because I would have assumed that you would show it to them, most importantly, to have them understand you and who you were. But in fact, if it's a tool for you at all, it's one that helps them understand the choice that they might make for themselves.
I mean, I haven't gone so far that I'm busy of explaining to my kids who I was when I was 19. You know? I mean, it's hard enough to communicate now, you know, while traveling and everything. So I haven't, it's too much. But if it's just a more general statement in terms of what the army is, what war is, how does it look, and learn from what your father went through, it's more than enough for me.
How is the film being used today in Israel by people who have seen it, who can directly relate to that time in history?
It's not just that time in history. My life has changed extremely in the past eight months since the film was launched in Cannes Film Festival in May. And I've been traveling with the film a lot. But when I'm in Israel, I mean, I can't go to any public events anymore. Because in the end, I find myself in the corner sitting with a guy I never met before, of course, who tells me all his horrific war stories. It could be any one of the wars that Israel went through, and there were a lot. So in the end, and he tells all that to me because he saw the film and immediately he felt the urge to talk, to speak. And the only thing I can tell them is, yeah, why not go make a movie out of it? You know, it's it is like scratching an old scar for a lot of people in Israel, at least. It's incredible.
Is it a scar that needed scratching?
For them, I'm not that sure. Honestly, I don't know. It's very personal. They should know.
Ari Folman's new film is called Waltz with Bashir. It is an animated documentary that opens January 16th at the Angelica Theater in Dallas. You can learn more about it at waltzwithbashir.com. Ari, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.